Okay, now we're ready. Okay. Meanwhile, so how do we know whether this guy acted reasonably or was negligent? And procedurally, what happened? And just tell me a little story here about what he files the complaint, goes to trial. Again, one of the things that is important for us in terms of figuring out what to take away from the case is sort of its procedural history. Did it get dismissed before it ever got to trial? Was it dismissed after it was in trial? Was there a directed verdict? Was there an error in the jury instructions? So how the case gets set up helps us figure out what it means. Okay. Yeah, which I think would be the equivalent or the normal term we use there is a directed verdict. And what's the standard for that, going back to the turntable case? You're entitled to a directed verdict, a judgment as a matter of law, when... What's the standard there? Okay, Mr. Breck? Okay, was there anything in dispute here? Even if the facts aren't disputed, going back to the turntable case, even when the facts are undisputed, the railroad employees saw the kids played on this thing, they had a broken latch and so forth, we still needed a jury where... Okay, yeah. Okay, where reasonable minds could not differ about the outcome. So a directed verdict is appropriate where the evidence, remember the turntable case discussion, the court gives you this image of a carriage going off the cliff, saying, well, I can imagine a set of circumstances where the evidence would be so clear that no reasonable person could disagree with the proposition the plaintiff ought to win. Or I could imagine another set of facts where no reasonable person could disagree with the proposition that the defendant ought to win. Does this case fit the situation where reasonable minds couldn't differ in evaluating his prudence in swatting this wasp rather than what is it the plaintiff says he should have done? I mean, it's always sort of compared to what? You were negligent because you did this instead of that, or you didn't do such and so when you should have done something other. What is it that what is it the plaintiff is accusing this guy of doing or failing to do? He swatted the wasp when he should have. Well, he was actually trying to drive the car and swat the wasp at the same time, and that's kind of what got him into trouble. His alternative, rather than swatting the wasp, was, yeah, pull over, open the window, do something else. Don't get into a seek and destroy mission with this wasp flying around. Wait for a better opportunity. Now, with 20/20 hindsight, that probably would have been a smarter thing to do. But is this a case where reasonable minds could only reach one conclusion? What does the appellate court say? No. It's a case where, gee, obviously if the jury had said this guy was negligent, we could certainly live with that. But if the jury says his behavior wasn't negligent, we can live with that too. And in a way, we're forced to live with that. Again, we sing this little hymn of praise to the jury system that the juries give us this kind of broader perspective. They make this connection between the legal system that governs us and, you know, you and I as citizens get called upon to sit on juries and make these decisions. So it's not something coming at us from above, but it's you and I deciding how we and our neighbors are going to live together. That's the theory of what makes the jury system so wonderful. So, again, this is an example in the court's view of a case where, gee, the people on the jury drive cars, they're passengers in cars, they're familiar with WASPs. If they thought this guy's behavior was reasonable, so be it. Was it perfect? No. But did it meet the standard of reasonable care? Yeah. So they say. Now, again, the emphasis here is not so much, I want to remind us of what it is I'm hoping you will feel confident about doing when you get time to write an exam answer. And the assignment in an exam is typically advise your client about what to expect. And oftentimes you will have a strong instinct about what should happen in a case. The plaintiff deserves to win or the plaintiff doesn't deserve to win. And that's a useful little datum that if the people on the jury think as you do, and some of them undoubtedly will, then it would turn out the way you think it ought to turn out. But one of the things you have to temper that instinct with is the reminder that, in fact, you won't sit on the jury. You will be your client's advocate. You hope to persuade the people on the jury to think as you do, or perhaps you're afraid they will think as you do. You think your client's a dead duck. But in fact, the jury may think differently. They may decide your client really was okay, even though you think what he or she did was pretty stupid. And vice versa. They may think your client was pretty stupid when you think your client did something that was okay, or vice versa. You think you're confident a jury would find the defendant acted stupidly and your client should therefore recover. But again, remember that the jury doesn't always think as you do. It's also sort of good as we go along to sort of see yourself in the general spectrum of opinion. Some of you come from backgrounds or life experience or philosophical orientation where you're oriented toward plaintiffs. And you think in general people get a raw deal and big institutions and insurance companies are stingy with their money and you're generally on the side of the plaintiff. Others of you come from the other end of the spectrum, where you're sick and tired of other people blaming all their troubles on people that happen to be fortunate enough or have worked hard enough to make some money. And your impulse is to be with the defendant most of the time. And occasionally you'll say, yeah, okay, that plaintiff deserves to recover, but it doesn't happen very often. Again, if you find yourself sort of it doesn't mean you're wrong. It simply means when I try to advise my client about where I think a judge or a jury would come out on these issues, I don't want to pretend that everybody who's going to be making the decision, the sort of random sample of opinion that's going to show up on the jury, I don't want to be overly optimistic or, for that matter, overly pessimistic. You don't help your client by being overly pessimistic. If they've got a decent shot at coming out of this case okay, you don't want to say, well, gee, if I were on the jury, I wouldn't give you a nickel, or I'd make you pay through the nose. You want to give your client as clear a picture of the variation such that they then have the tools with which to make decisions about whether to fold their cards and go home, or whether to plant their flag and fight for it. So again, that we start with this kind of modest little case here before we get into all the complexity of legal doctrines and interesting theories and elements of causes of action and all that sort of stuff, to sort of get a perspective of the fact that much of your case may involve jurors making judgment calls about debatable points. And to that extent, you want to identify what the debatable points are, but advise your client about the range of possibilities. Questions about Lausanne? Okay, now we have this other interesting little case here, Vaughan versus Menlove, an older English case. By the way, just for your information, we have these cases. They're not online, so far as I know. Maybe somebody's put all these older English cases online. I don't think so. But someplace up in the stacks there are these older cases. One of the phenomena that you observe is a kind of, if I were a Darwinian, I would say it was sort of a tree of life here. You have this explosion of cases, so that if you tracked over time the number of reported cases, they would sort of look like this. And the last, 40 years have the vast majority of cases. You go back 60, 80, 100, 150 years, you got a pretty small number of cases that would fit on a shelf, certainly on a piece of microfilm. Okay, so Vaughan versus Menlove. Ms. Hong, why don't you tell us about Vaughan versus Menlove? Okay, so the plaintiff wants the defendant pay for the damage caused by this fire, and tell me the procedural history of this case. Mm-hmm. Right. There is some hint here. It's not exactly clear what disability he suffered from, but apparently he did have some kind of disability. And so he's saying that the standard used in assessing whether he was negligent or not was the wrong standard, and it's essentially a complaint about the jury instruction. What does he say is the proper way to phrase or frame the standard of reasonable care? According to the defendant, in assessing negligence, you want to ask what question? Okay. And just so we're clear, what's the difference between that and the standard that was applied? Okay, so the standard that was applied was to compare his behavior to that of some hypothetical, abstract, reasonable person, not customized or adapted to this particular individual. And he says, by contrast, the standard should have been, did I essentially do the best I could with my ability? Did he, the phrase he wants to use is, did he act bona fides? In fact, isn't that in what's that movie? Brother, where art thou? It's Holly Hunter, isn't she the actress that plays the, bona fide? I forget who it was, or some stupid thing. Like that. In any event, but that's the idea. Did he act in good faith? What's the appeal of either of those standards? Tell me the advantages or disadvantages of using one as compared to the other. Disadvantage of which? Mm-hmm. Or it would vary according to the individual. Now, we can contrast these two by referring to the one the court imposed as an objective standard, and the other one being a subjective standard. That is, the objective standard doesn't vary from defendant to defendant. It's the same, whereas the proposed standard the defendant wants us to use is a subjective one, that is essentially how well did he do with what he was given in life. Now, does the law ever employ a subjective standard? Does our treatment under the law ever depend upon some evaluation of the interior of our subjective state of mind, of whether we were acting in good faith or not? Where? It's Mr. Edwards, right? Yeah. Okay. There's a particular area in the law of torts in which we adapt the standard to a, but even there, it's a reasonably prudent child. We're not so much interested in the subjective good faith of this particular 8-year-old. We ask, what would a reasonably prudent 8-year-old do? Anywhere else in the law where we employ a standard of good faith? Yes, sir. But in what kind of context? You mean in tort law, or in with respect to whether we institutionalize somebody? Obviously, the law requires that before, unlike the Soviet Union, and where you could get shipped out of the gulag because they thought you were mentally ill. In our country, well, sure, the same standard, except we hopefully do it in an appropriate way. If you're schizophrenic, self-destructive, etc., we can, against your will, stick you in a mental institution. But there are standards to try to protect us from the government misusing that power. But what about whether you win a lawsuit or you get thrown in jail for committing a crime? Is it ever a subjective standard that we use? Mr. Boyer? Sure, or even the difference between different levels of murder. That is, you can be convicted of a more serious version of murder if you have a certain state of mind. If you, in fact, have the purpose of causing someone's death, as opposed to having it happen because you were driving recklessly or because you were driving carelessly. Your punishment will depend upon this evaluation, and it's not always easy. If somebody says it was an accident, in fact, I was just watching some 14-year-old sent to prison for life. I was getting dressed this morning and watching the morning news show, and they had some 14-year-old who was sentenced to life for killing a 6-year-old girl, and he claimed it was an accident, and they claimed it was murder. Well, whether he goes to jail for that period of time depends upon an evaluation of his subjective state of mind. So we can do it. Why would we choose in this circumstance to do it or not do it? Why is it that it's appropriate or inappropriate in the context of deciding whether this guy has to pay for the damage to his neighbor's property? Ms. Hong, again, you were saying difficult. I think you started out by saying it's not always easy to peer into another person's heart, in effect, or decide whether they're acting in good faith. Some people can fool you. They can put up a good front of being sincere, and in fact they're lying through their teeth. We sort of think we can tell, but we doubt our ability to do that. It's easier in a way to set a standard that doesn't require that, that simply says, well, in swatting a wasp, for example, would a reasonable person do this? Not so much, was this guy trying the best he could, or was he, by contrast, not acting in good faith, putting his needs ahead of other people's needs and being selfish about it? So it's a little bit easier to do it if we make our reference point some objective standard. What about the moral basis of it? Would we be a better society if we made questions like this turn on the person's good faith, how hard they were trying? Just while you're thinking about that, I remember being, I don't know, I was maybe in fifth or sixth grade or something like that, when we started getting report cards that I had gotten report cards with just, you know, a grade or a one or a two or whatever they were using by way of evaluating the student's progress. And then suddenly at one of these grades, fifth or sixth grade, they gave us three different grades for each subject. So for spelling or for arithmetic, it would be the grade for, I forget what they called it, performance or achievement. Then there was a grade for effort, and there was a grade for conduct. I understood how they could evaluate conduct. You know, did I punch my, you know, the kid next to me? You know, did I throw spit wads? And, you know, did I pay attention? Did I shut up when the teacher told me to? I could understand how they could grade performance. You know, how many correct answers did I get on the arithmetic test? But I could never figure out how they would judge effort. I recognize this subjective difficulty, but would we be a better society if we had legal standards based upon how hard people were trying rather than looking only to what they were able to achieve? Mr. Brecht? And just while we're on that point, let's pause for a moment and ask the question, if we had imposed the standard the defendant wanted us to, if we had used a subjective standard and asked whether he was trying the best he could, what do you think the jury would have said in answer to that question? Same result. I mean, it seems like when people were trying, assuming this guy had some kind of disability, that he wasn't as smart about haystacks as his neighbors were, and his neighbors recognized this and actually tried to help him, we don't know with what degree of condescension or superiority or what have you, but somebody tried to help him do a better job, and he basically said, buzz off. So it didn't appear that he was trying the best he could. All of us, of course, are reluctant to acknowledge our need of other people to help us get through life, but if this guy wants a standard about good faith, he doesn't look like he's going to do very well. So on this particular case, it's maybe not the best example of how to judge it, but assuming he had been trying the best he could, but he still, despite his best efforts, couldn't figure out how to prevent this thing from happening. Is it fair to make his neighbor put up with it? Remembering again that the effect of a decision not to impose liability is that the loss, instead of falling on the defendant, falls on the plaintiff. Or to put it the other way around, when we impose liability, we shift the loss from the plaintiff to the defendant. And although we might say it's not fair to make somebody pay for something they couldn't personally help. They simply didn't have the resources with which to prevent this accident from happening. If we look around and we say, yeah, but most people could, a reasonable person would have figured it out, would have avoided this accident. Is it any more fair to say the plaintiff has to suffer because of the defendant's disability than to say, in effect, the defendant will have to suffer because the defendant, for reasons we don't understand, the elevator didn't go to the top floor, however you want to put it. Lights were on, but nobody was home. That may not be his fault, but if the reality is that he can't meet the standard, why is it we're going to give him a free pass on that and simply say, well, do the best you can, the rest of us will try to navigate around you. Is correct? Okay. And that's actually a very good question as to where we draw the comparison. What would you say is the difference between Hammond Tree and Menlove? If you're going to defend what happened in Hammond Tree, but say the court did the right thing in Vaughn versus Menlove, how would you distinguish those two cases? Ms. Hong? Yeah? Okay, but and remember in the previous case, we decided that the behavior of this particular guy, the guy with the seizure disorder, didn't act negligently. The plaintiff conceded as much. We're not saying this guy acted negligently. We're saying that the damage that he caused should be subjected to a rule of strict liability, that he should still have to compensate even though he wasn't negligent. In this particular case, we say that Menlove was negligent even though his failure to live up to the standard of reasonable care may have been due to a similar kind of organic, perhaps. You know, maybe he was schizophrenic, or maybe he was, maybe he had Down syndrome, maybe he had some other condition that made him less capable than the average person of correctly perceiving reality. In that sense, it's due to no fault of his own, but he failed to live up to the standard of a reasonably prudent person. And the law, in a sense, differentiates between physical disabilities and mental disabilities to say if you can't make the standard because of a mental disability, we won't cut you any slack for that. But if you can't meet the standard because of a physical disability, we will adapt the standard to that of a reasonably prudent blind person or a reasonably prudent person with a seizure disorder. Now, if your seizure disorder is such that you shouldn't drive a car, you can't drive a car, then a reasonably prudent person with a seizure disorder would say, I'm not going to drive. A reasonably prudent blind person wouldn't drive. But if the risk that they're taking is one that we accept as being reasonable, then the fact that they have this physical disability leads to an adaptation. But we don't make that distinction for mental disabilities, and perhaps it's a form of prejudice. We're more sort of disturbed by mental disabilities than we are by physical disabilities. Mental illness scares us in a way that physical illness does not. But so be it. Again, part of the difficulty is you can demonstrate that a person is blind. you can't demonstrate that a person has a mental disability quite as easily. What exactly is wrong with John Hinckley? John Hinckley's in St. Elizabeth's Hospital. He wants to go home or wants to have an extended visit, even though he shot the president and James Brady, whatever that was, 20 years ago. And at the time, the doctors diagnosed him as having a mental disorder. He had narcissistic personality disorder. He couldn't accurately perceive other people's needs. His own needs took such priority to him that it was more important that he impress Jodie Foster, even if he had to shoot the president to do it, than to recognize, yeah, but that would be selfish. He had a narcissistic personality disorder. That's a mental disease? I guess. Again, you know, drawing the line, well, what's the difference between that and somebody who says, gee, I'd like to get rich and I'll go rob a bank? And yeah, they don't correctly perceive the fact that the people they're shooting at are, you know, herding into the safe so they can take the money and run. Anyway, okay. But again, the rationally or irrationally, the law makes this distinction and says, if it's a mental disorder or mental disability, we're not interested. If it's a physical disability, we will make some adjustment. And again, the morality of it is a larger question about the law in general. If you're buying and selling stock in the New York Stock Exchange, the coin of the realm is guessing correctly about the future value of those stocks. If you guess right, you make a lot of money. If you guess wrong, you lose a lot of money. If you're able to remember a lot of information and so forth, you can make a lot of dough. If you're well-meaning but not as skilled at it, you can get creamed. And in effect, the tort system is not unlike that. We live in a world in which the financial rewards to people depend upon how skilled you are at doing things. Does it mean that one person is better than another? No. But the world works a little bit better, so we think, when we essentially say, you know, play the cards that you're dealt. Now, we may recognize that there is another realm, a more important realm, perhaps, where the question will be, you know, the parable of the talents. Not so much, how much did you produce, but what did you do with what you were given? You know, to whom much has been given, much will be required. And Mother Teresa says, you know, you're not asked to be successful, only to be faithful. And in that realm, it's a complete opposite. It doesn't matter what you've achieved. What matters is, Have you acted in good faith relative to what you have? But the law, for better or for worse, works on a different principle. And one of the reasons it operates on a different principle is I'm not so sure I'm enthusiastic about the prospect of the government taking over the role of being my judge. I trust the supernatural judge in ways I don't trust the people who run my government. So when the government says, I'm going to judge you by what you produce, you may be a rotten human being, but if you obey the law and meet the standards, you will get rewarded. You may be a very well-meaning, heart-of-gold human being, but you make lousy decisions and you have bad luck. The law essentially gives you money or takes your money away. And one could look at that and say it's an immoral system, but you could also look at it and say, well, considering the alternative of having the government take over the role of being my judge, maybe I'm okay with the way it is. So again, it's an important principle we have in the tort system that there is a connection between law and morality. In a sense, the standard of reasonable care recognizes the immorality of being careless and causing other people's harm. It also recognizes the morality of compensating people who get injured, particularly by the people who caused that injury. But there's also a certain disconnect where there are things which we could clearly recognize would be moral, but they get no reward, and we recognize things that are immoral, and they don't get punished. And if you want a perfect correspondence between law and morality, you're probably going to be disappointed. But if you think they're completely disjointed, you'd also be incorrect in that respect as well. Okay, next case, Adams versus Bullock. Mr. Swenson, why don't you tell us about Adams versus Bullock? Yeah, so you've got, if you've been in Seattle or San Francisco or one of these places with electric trolleys where it's got an overhead conductor, goes from the bus up to this bare conductor up here, you get the power from this line into the bus to run the motor because it's not insulated. And they thought they were safe by having it underneath this sort of a parapet here. But apparently he's walking along the bridge swinging this pole. Unbeknownst to him, this pole has enough flexibility so that it swings around. And if the voltage is high enough, you don't even have to contact it. It'll arc and instantaneously form that electrical connection. And suddenly he becomes the object of electricity intended for these trolleys. Tell me the procedural history of the case. Okay. Okay, and what's the question? And remember, New York has this odd system where they call their trial courts the Supreme Court. They call their intermediate courts the appellate division. And then they call the top of the food chain is the Court of Appeals. So you appeal from the Supreme Court ultimately to the Court of Appeals. It's just the opposite of what we would think of if we're thinking of the federal court system or most state court systems patterned on the federal system. Okay. But anyway, we're up here in the Court of Appeals. And what's the issue that they're trying to resolve? Okay. And what's their thinking on that point? What does the court think with respect to whether or not the defendant was negligent? First of all, let's see if we can get an idea of the plaintiff's, the substance of the plaintiff's argument here. In what respect does the plaintiff say the defendant acted negligently? Okay. Yeah. There was no protection from this kind of accident. And the plaintiff says a reasonable person would have shielded this line from contact with the plaintiff. And the jury agreed. And the appellate division agreed. What does the Court of Appeals say? Why not? Where did we fail in thinking that this was negligent? Well, impossible to insulate it and have it fulfill this function. That is, if you're going to have, you know, you got the trolley down here and have this thing that goes up there and goes down the street continuously supplying electricity, it can't be an insulated wire. But that's not the only way to run a trolley, obviously. Other ways to run the railroad. You could have a steam-fired thing, or you could have one that's underneath the ground, or you could do... Why is it not negligent for them to leave this hazard the way it is? Is it Mr. Kamal? Okay, there's the suggestion here about foreseeability, and we'll get later on. In fact, the judge who writes this, Judge Cardozo, is, we see his name pop up periodically throughout this course, as it turns out, a very famous judge. Cardozo uses this term foreseeability. In fact, he writes this very famous case, Paul's Graph case, which is all about foreseeability in Chapter 2, at the end of Chapter 2. But I don't think he's basing the entire decision on the fact that, gee, we never could have imagined this. I suspect that the people who built this system had it in their minds that every once in a while you would get these freakish kinds of accidents, that there would be some, you know, a line would break or a tree would fall or different things would happen such that these lines would come in contact with other and people would get hurt. Even if you could imagine, or as you studied other trolley systems, you found out that every once in a while bad things would happen, it still wouldn't be negligent to build and operate a system like this. Why? Yes, Ms. Williams. Okay, and what's bad about being an insurer? And what's wrong with that? Wouldn't we all feel safer if we knew that the trolley company was going to pay for whatever injuries we suffered? That's right. That's Cardozo's bottom line. We could do it, but it would be way too expensive. Now, later on, we're going to talk more explicitly about a sort of quantified comparison. Here, Cardozo is only talking about a general concept, that the whole idea behind reasonable care is we make trade-offs. There are certain risks that we take because failing to take that risk would deprive us of something more valuable. I let my kid play high school football, or I, you know, go do this thing or that thing, knowing that there are risks associated with it, but there's a sufficiently large payoff, so he thinks, that it will be worth it. Now, ordinarily, who makes that kind of balance? Mr. Swenson, whom do we trust to say whether or not, in effect, a precaution was worth taking? Who's our point person on the umpire, the referee here? Who functionally in the system? What's that? Yeah, the court, and by way of the jury. Here the jury said that it was negligent. But Cardozo thinks the jury wasn't, in effect, dealing from a full deck. The jury, we never get a more detailed description of the plaintiff's evidence. We're not exactly sure what the plaintiff was comparing it to. Maybe the plaintiff made a pretty good case that there was some relatively affordable precaution. But the impression you get from reading Cardozo's opinion is essentially the plaintiff said, hey, this was a preventable accident. And Cardozo says, yeah, your point being, compared to what? What do we have to sacrifice in order to prevent this accident. Unless you can show me that that's a reasonable sacrifice to make, what are we giving up? Are we giving up trolley systems? Heaven forbid. We like trolleys. They get us places we want to go. Simply having an accident isn't enough to establish your right to compensation. You've got to show that there was something a reasonable person could have done to prevent this, and it's not by rolling over and playing dead. There's got to be some affordable safety measure that could be taken. And again, Cardozo, as we'll see, is a guy who likes to sit at the controls. He doesn't particularly trust juries. You'll see that again in the negligence per se case, Martin versus Herzog. He doesn't trust juries. But he does have a point here of saying, again, we don't see what the jury saw, but unless you can show me that there was something a reasonable person would have done to prevent this accident, simply showing that the boy got hurt isn't enough. We'll have to pick that up again tomorrow. Any last books that I can get rid of? If you want a book and you want to give me the money tomorrow, that's fine too. I just want to as many. And the other thing I need to know is how many more books I need. I'm hoping to get rid of all the ones I have and order just a few more. So if you want a book, take one today and pay me later.